And now for some individual accounts from the protest at the Republican National Convention in New York.
I'm Arun Bala.
I'm Zoe Ginsberg.
And I'm Sarah Knaus, reporting on our experiences in the custody of the New York Police Department this week during the Republican National Convention.
At 4 p.m. on Tuesday, August 31st, five members of the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center were arrested in a mass roundup of peaceful demonstrators just one block from the site of the former World Trade Center in New York City. The arrest led to a two-and-a-half-day ordeal for the demonstrators and their loved ones as the New York Police Department and the Department of Corrections attempted to clear the streets of demonstrators during the Republican National Convention.
The march, organized by the War Resisters League and the School of the Americas Watch, assembled at the World Trade Center to march to Madison Square Garden in an effort to bring the sober legacy of September 11th home to the RNC, which was widely reviled in New York City for capitalizing on the attacks for a political gain. An estimated 400 people were arrested shortly after police had announced that the march, which did not have a permit to close the street, must remain on the sidewalk and obey New York City traffic laws. Demonstrators were moving along the sidewalk, leaving about 2.5 feet of space for other pedestrian traffic, and attempting to organize themselves to walk two abreast, when the police suddenly blew a whistle and announced that everyone was under arrest. The police gave no order to disperse prior to surrounding the march and beginning the process of handcuffing everyone on the block, including a German tourist, a New Yorker who wanted to watch the demonstration, and a 17-year-old woman from Delaware visiting New York for the first time.
Zoe Ginsberg, a 16-year-old Urbana resident and student at University High School, was held for 37 hours before being released at 5:30 a.m. on Thursday morning. When she asked an officer what she was being charged with, the officer replied that she did not know. Zoe and other UCIMC members Zach Miller of Urbana, Colleen Cook of Champaign, Arun Bala of Champaign, and Sarah Knaus of Chicago were never formally informed of their arrest charges, but were assured by their arresting officers, Officer Hector Jordan and Detective Nicholas Stanich, that they'd be released before the next morning. None of the group was set free before Wednesday afternoon, and Sarah Knaus, the last of the group to be released, left the New York Criminal Court at 6:45 p.m. on Thursday after being held in custody for over 50 hours.
Hey, this is Sarah calling from inside the detention facility in New York. Please, somebody upload this to the main Indymedia newswire. We were arrested at 4 p.m. yesterday at the World Trade Center site, and after 2 hours waiting in the sun, we're taken to the Spear detention facility, which is a large garage-like space. It's filthy. It's a 57-foot pier with 10-foot tall with razor wires, about 50 feet by 75 feet that was pulled up to 100 people in each pen. There were 10 of those and then a much larger one. Mostly people slept on the floor, so all of us are covered with a thin layer of slime and soot.
The demonstrators were initially taken by the busload to Pier 57, a makeshift holding pen in a warehouse quickly dubbed Guantanamo on the Hudson by prisoners and the media alike. As many as 90 prisoners at a time were held in 20 by 40 foot pens made with 15 foot chain link fencing capped with razor wire. The three benches in the pens were far too small to seat all the prisoners, who were forced to sit or sleep on the bare, oily residue and chemical covered floor. Two porta potties serviced each cell, which filled quickly during the lengthy holding period, which for many prisoners exceeded 18 hours. Most of the pens were not supplied with trash disposal, and the cells filled quickly with stale, half-eaten sandwiches, crushed paper cups, and empty milk cartons.
When the media received word of the conditions at Pier 57 and arranged a photo opportunity after the prisoners were transferred, the police department attempted to conceal the conditions by thoroughly mopping the floor and laying new carpet. While a few demonstrators received plastic sheeting to lie down, the vast majority were offered nothing and emerged from Pier 57 covered in fine black grit. A large number of arrestees received rashes and blisters, and still more reported severe headaches, sore throats, and hacking coughs in the hours and days following their transfer. Medics who treated demonstrators upon their release recommended that they first take cold showers to avoid absorbing the substances from Pier 57 floor, and were taking clothing samples to analyze the composition of the greasy grit.
On August 31st, over 1,000 people were swept up in massive arrests, handcuffed, fingerprinted, photographed, and held in custody. Most of them were charged with very minor violations that are usually handled by writing a field appearance ticket, which orders the violator to be arraigned in court at a later date. The hundreds of prisoners, most of whom had never been arrested before, overwhelmed the system that usually handles 200 to 300 arrests per day. While the police claim that the holdup was a result of simply having too many people in the system, prisoners claim that the system itself, not to mention the unnecessary arrest of hundreds of peaceful demonstrators and bystanders, was responsible for the delays. Very few prisoners were moved from Pier 57 during the night following their arrest, creating a huge backlog for the police, corrections, and the courts in the following days. Arrestees who were taken to the hospital for treatment of medical conditions, including the administration of their routine prescription medication, had their papers taken out of the system until they were returned, backlogging the system for everyone. Early in the week, only one arrestee was arraigned at a time, even though many had the same charges. Delays due to overcrowding and poor planning were not inevitable. Under pressure from protesters outside the jail, families of the arrestees, the National Lawyers Guild, and an eventual court order that fined the NYPD $1,000 for every person held longer than 24 hours, the arraignment process accelerated dramatically, with three demonstrators facing a judge at once.
The excruciating delays wore down the prisoners' health and energy and kept many demonstrators off the street for more than 2 days. Lawyers and protesters believe that the delays were designed to prevent people from exercising their free speech rights and voicing their opposition during Bush's acceptance speech on Thursday. Norman Siegel of the National Lawyers Guild, which represented thousands of arrestees, alleged the city of New York attempted to lose the people currently held in central booking until after Bush gave his speech tonight, after which they would miraculously be found. Donna Lieberman of the New York Civil Liberties Union issued a statement regarding police tactics. The preemptive arrests, preventive detentions, dangerous conditions at Pier 57, and massive surveillance of lawful protest activity undermined the right to dissent. The department's practices were inconsistent and its standards were unclear from day to day. As a result, perfectly lawful actions could result in an arrest on any given day and time. That stifles dissent in political debates.
Whatever the source of the delays, prisoners and, to a lesser extent, rank-and-file officers experienced the brunt of the difficulties they caused. Few prisoners were offered a phone call until well over 24 hours into their detention, if at all. Zoe Ginsberg was unable to call her parents for over 30 hours to confirm that she was in jail, and that, due to a New York law that allows 16-year-olds to sign their own legal papers, they didn't need to fly to New York to get her released. Medical conditions were regularly ignored for hours and then required transfer to a hospital for treatment. Even at the jail, conditions were overcrowded and uncomfortable. Sarah Canal spent 10 hours overnight in an 8-by-9-foot cell with seven prisoners huddled on the concrete floor to warm each other enough to sleep. But most disorienting and demoralizing were the long waits, with hopes for release rising with every transfer to a new cell, and then dashed again by inaccurate and conflicting information from the police and guards, who themselves were often more confused than malicious in dealing with their unusual prisoners. Protesters experienced moments of solidarity with the police, who have been working without a contract for over 2 years, and who clearly received inadequate training for a week of 15-hour shifts. Sarah witnessed a guard open the windows wider during a prisoner chant so the sound could travel better, and some guards allowed prisoners to make multiple phone calls on their office phones. But other officers were hostile to arrestees, created arbitrary rules, fastened handcuffs too tight, threatened unnecessary searches, bullied and yelled, and psychologically destabilized prisoners with lies and constantly changing estimates of the time remaining until their release.
A common refrain of both the police and the New York media was that if someone attends a demonstration, he or she should expect to get arrested. One of the corrections officers who expressed sympathy with a protester's cause added, "Of course, if you're going to protest, you've got to expect that this will happen." But to the demonstrators, this is a backwards way to look at the detention. If free speech and free assembly are among our most important constitutionally guaranteed rights, people should not be expected to spend 2 days behind bars as the price exacted for voicing their conscience.